Good afternoon. It's Friday the 26th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today is Ben Rubin and Debbie Evans. Welcome to the programme, both. We'll get kicked off with some more serious stuff in a second, but we'll just start with the Commonwealth being 75 years old today. So this is the anniversary of the London meeting, the London Declaration, which began it all. And they were very keen to tweet out this morning that this was their birthday. If you aren't aware of why that is significant with respect to globalism and global governance and so on, have a look at this article in the UK Column website, Multiple Paths Lead to One World Government. And that will put it in a bit of context for you. But I'll just read a couple of lines from this. Martin Edwards saying that we live in a world of agenda politics is absolutely clear. Governments come and go, but the agenda never changes. Policies left incomplete by one government are taken up with gusto by the next. Civil servants get involved in writing party manifestos. One of the most obvious of the agendas that our politicians are pushing is that of world government. The British Parliament is now subservient to so many foreign bodies and institutions it's hard to keep count. This is not a new agenda. It's been pushed since before the 20th century by, amongst others, the Rat Pack of the Huxleys, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell and the like. And it finds its expression in a host of organisations, think tanks, NGOs and committees. The most obvious example of those organisations is, of course, Julian Huxley's United Nations. And then he goes on to talk about the Commonwealth and its role in this whole thing. But if we put that back on screen, I'll just highlight H.G. Wells in particular, because we've said before that most people think of him as a science fiction writer, but he has written many other books on less science fiction-y type of topics, including this one, The Open Conspiracy, What Are We to Do with Our Lives? It's had a couple of covers over the over the years, but we shouldn't forget that H.G. Wells was one of the founders of the Fabian Society, who want to mold the world. And just to highlight a couple of the points from this book, the policy agendas that he was pushing in this book was the idea that we end the nation state forever, that we control human population, that we eliminate the notion that man is created in the image of God, and that Russia is a crucial target for assimilation into this whole agenda. Debbie, the Commonwealth has a role to play in this creation of global governance alongside the United Nations and so on, but its particular focus is net zero, of course.
Oh, yes. Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you. So much to say about the Commonwealth. So I'll try to make this really brief because I think it's really important we highlight this, that the if you're watching in a Commonwealth country, and if you know someone that's in a Commonwealth country, please tell them to keep an eye on No Smoke, the Green King, because this is really significant. The Commonwealth is huge. It's huge. It's home to a third of the world's population. It's 2.5 billion in 56 countries. 60% of the Commonwealth population are under 29. So that's really important. They're very, very young. And of course, we've got King Charles, AstraZeneca, Terra Carta wants to restore a third of the world to biodiversity. A third of the world is the Commonwealth. Kanzuk, superpowers, super Commonwealth. Perhaps we'll come on to talk a bit more in extra, but a lot to say. Watch the Commonwealth.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Thank you for that, Debbie. Now, Ben, you've mentioned anthropy before, but let's bring it up to date.
Absolutely, yes. So anthropy have sprung back into action. But what is anthropy? Let's hear, first of all, from anthropy founder, John O'Brien.
Anthropy is based on two principles. The first being that the future of our country is a shared responsibility. The second is dynamic stewardship, the fact that we are custodians of our great institutions, our natural landscape, our heritage, our laws, and much more. But if they're going to be fit for the rest of this century and beyond, then it's our job as custodians to shape them for the future. Anthropy affords the ability for you as leaders to join us in helping create that national agenda, either through our national gathering or through our alliances around the country. Do consider helping shape the future of Britain through anthropy.
So it's a big national conversation It takes place every year at the Eden Project. We had that up at the start. You can see some images here of people attending the event back in November. Lots of talk and discussions focused on all the hot topics of the day. And it actually describes itself as being inspired by the fusion of ideas for a UK Davos, referring to the World Economic Forum event in January, a Glastonbury for Good, and a national TED Talk. To get an idea of the types of ideas that are being promoted here. It's also about breaking down barriers to collaboration across the public, private and sectors and what they call civil society. They use this term, leaving your silo at the door a lot. This is all about breaking down the barriers between organisations and technical disciplines. Very common purpose, this kind of language. And ostensibly, it's all focused on inspiring a better Britain. That's what they get together to talk about. It's all about individual and collective action. They've got a nice little process where you shape your agenda, activate your sphere of influence, accelerate action through collaboration, and then amplify success to inspire others. This is their kind of infinity loop of pushing their ideas out into the system, very similar to B Corp and a bunch of these other organizations. And actually, they had B Corp along to speak back in November. Now, they're not doing their event this year. It's going to be held next March because it clashed with COP, so the big climate conference. A lot of the same attendees, you get the idea. But this week, they launched their big insights report for 2024, which is about getting the mood of the nation. It came out on Tuesday. It was on Monday, and it was presented by John O'Brien, who we just saw speaking, who's the founder of Anthropy, and Kelly Beaver, who's the chief executive of Ipsos, the global market research firm. And Ipsos have run a big national survey, quite a significant piece of work, actually, that they've been running over the past 6 months. There's a bit of a demographic breakdown here, but most importantly is to understand that they interviewed the anthropists, so 765 people who attended the event in November, but then also the public at large as well. So 2,237 people from the British public were asked the same question, which is essentially, what do you see as the single most important issue facing the UK today? Now, for the anthropists, it was all about climate change, pollution and the environment, as well as poverty and inequality and the lack of faith in politics and government. Entertainingly, they are completely misaligned with the UK public. The UK public doesn't care about any of that stuff. What the UK public is interested in is inflation and prices, a lot of that inflation driven by World Economic Forum policies that form the backbone of what Anthropy get together to promote and talk about. They're also interested in the NHS, hospitals and healthcare, actually having a functioning health system, that'd be quite good, and the economy. And also fourth on the list for the UK public, which didn't figure at all for the anthropists, is immigration. Yeah, so there's a total misalignment between what these leaders who want to get together and talk about the future of the country are interested in and what everyone else is interested in, which the anthropists explain about as them having a more long-term and strategic view of the issues. It's got to the fact that they are a completely different set of people to the British public, and actually their interests are completely misaligned. So despite that, they've actually set out and gone ahead and put forward these eight key priorities for the Anthropy community to be promoting: children and young people, investment in public health services, economic prosperity, cross-sector collaboration, climate change and natural places, education reform, addressing inequality, political and electoral reform. All of that obviously sounds really cuddly and cozy and inoffensive, but when you dig into what they're promoting, it's basically all of the bad things that we talk about on the news here every single week, whether that's citizens' assemblies, pouring endless amounts of money into things like genomic engineering, whatever it might be. If it's a World Economic Forum policy, or if it's coming from places like the Blair Institute for Global Change, then it's going to figure in what Anthropy are promoting. It's all the same stuff. Now, they're building out the network across the UK. They want to expand their influence and accelerate adoption of their ideas. And I would imagine, actually, just probably go meet some people who live outside the M25. That might be a good idea for this crowd. This was from the RSA event at the Royal Society of Arts on Monday, where they did the launch. So they've got a whole big plan for getting out across the country. Again, very similar to B Corp, but this is much more focused on the big mainstream corporations as opposed to small business. And why are we concerned about all of this? Because obviously they're getting together to talk about the future of the country, and they've got a real bright, optimistic vision for where we need to go to. But unfortunately, it's all backed by corporate interests. And so you can see here a list of their sponsors. I won't go through all of them because there's so many, but the ones that I'll just focus on are the founding partners of Anthropy, EY and Omnicom Group. Who are they, I hear you ask? Well, first of all, they're World Economic Forum partners. Yeah, so EY is a strategic partner of the World Economic Forum. Omnicom is also one of the top tier partners of the World Economic Forum. So they're intimately involved in the development and dissemination of policy for Klaus Schwab and his mates. What else do we know about EY? So EY's chief executive is on the steering board for the Council for Inclusive Capitalism, which is Linda Rothschild's philanthropic fund, her big play around transforming the economic system. They also sit right at the heart of the public-private partnership in the UK. You can see here, this is the main EY LinkedIn page, basically boasting about the fact that they're facilitating the public-private marketplace, the fascist marketplace, and that they've had people like Jeremy Hunt, Oliver Dowd and Keir Starmer, Andy Burnham, and many other mainstream politicians coming through. EY also sponsored Tortoise Media, by the way. This is a recent development, who is a partner with the Rothschild Foundation, which we've talked about a lot over the past weeks. So they've got some interesting people surrounding them. Omnicom, another kettle of fish, big on the COVID contracts, actually. So they picked up 3 weeks before the lockdown was announced, a £119 million communications contract. So obviously the government pretty much knew what they were going to do. All of the decision-making, the prevarication that we heard about in the media, really that didn't exist. They'd already signed up the big ad agency with £120 million worth of money to come and propagandise us. And actually, they then got another $320 million just over a year later in April 2021. Yeah, so that's nearly half a billion in taxpayer money going to Omnicom. And John O'Brien, who is the founder of Anthropy, who we just heard from, also worked at Omnicom while all that was going on. And actually, he's recently left to focus purely on Anthropy, but in his leaving address that he put out on his social media channels, he basically said quite simply, if it had been for Omnicom, Anthropy would not exist. Yeah, so this is all very much tied to corporate interests and as well as the uniparty interests. We talked a little bit about the public-private partnership. Well, at the end of last year, Anthropy received letters of recommendation from all three major party leaders in the UK, Sunak, Starmer and Ed Davey. Do you remember Ed Davey? The Lib Dems, what happened to them? We never hear about them anymore. Isn't that fascinating to see how that party just died away? Who else have they got on board? So Andy Haldane from the RSA. So the event that they launched the report at was held at the RSA. Andy Haldane, former chief economist of the Bank of England. And he was also at the Connected Places Catapult and Restitch event. A bunch of these people just spend their lives going around to conferences, as far as I can tell, including this guy, this next guy here, Kamal Ahmed. You can see the back of his head here. This is the only shot that they shared of him from the event. And Kamal Ahmed is very closely linked with the Tortoise Media editor, James Harding. He also runs the News Movement, which is a link to My Life, My Say, the UK youth charity trying to steal our elections I spoke about last week. And interestingly, Ahmed has just been appointed back to a senior position in mainstream news at The Telegraph, where he's going to be doing regular podcasting. So the Anthropy crowd are very much front and centre in the mainstream of media, politics, corporate interests and elsewhere. I'm really interested to see how this develops over the next 12 months.
Yeah, and Ben, the potential common purpose, I mean, I'd really like to know what the relationship is with common purpose, because it is the same type of language, the same type of agenda.
It's exactly the same type of language, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, thank you for that. Debbie, let's come over to you now. And vaccine injuries, and of course, it's not all rosy in the UK in general, but actually it's even worse in certain non-UK areas.
It absolutely is, yes. And I think everybody watching will find this quite shocking, because the king and the globalists, and I say the king for a reason, we'll come to that in a second, but the king and the globalists are pushing two, well, three, four huge agendas, but a couple of them, vaccinations, and another one, which is, of course, equality, diversity and inclusion. Isn't inclusion the buzzword at the moment? Well, many are finding themselves far from included. In fact, they're excluded. And I'm referring actually to the Channel Islands and to the Isle of Man. And it brings me on to BBC Guernsey, actually, because it's spring booster time. And shockingly, NHS England are reporting that 700,000 people in 1 week have signed up or been signed up for appointments. And in Guernsey and the Channel Islands, it's exactly the same. However, the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man are different to the UK. Now, I found a little bit of video just to explain how it's different to the UK. Have a little look at this.
These islands are part of the British Isles, but are not considered part of the United Kingdom. They are all part of the common travel area, which allows them to freely travel to the UK. So who do they belong to then? Is it Ireland or maybe even France? They are instead formally referred to as Crown Dependencies, which makes them a possession of the Crown. The King, as the ruling monarch, has the power to influence legislation, but the power is often not exercised without permission from the dependencies. They have their own parliament, government, and laws, making them self-governing. They also have their own British passports with their island names on them. They even have their own separate sports teams competing in the Commonwealth Games.
So you can see they're very different. And if you want to go and find out more, you can go to the government, uk.gov, and look at the Crown Dependencies, Jersey, Guernsey and the Isle of Man fact sheet. And if you go on further into the fact sheet, you can see the constitutional relationship. So this is the Crown Dependencies of Ballywick, Jersey, Ballywick, Guernsey and the Isle of Man. And you can see that they're part of the UK, but they're self-governing dependencies of the Crown. They've got their own directive, legislative, and the constitution, their constitutional relationship is actually maintained through the Crown. So the King heads the states for each island. And if you go to the Royal Family website, you can see a bit more about Crown Dependencies. And you can see that the Crown Dependencies are not part of the United Kingdom, but are self-governing possessions of the British Crown. So let's go to the Jersey government website, just as an example, because we're going to be talking about the compensation scheme that we know is available. I'm not saying it's accessible, but it's available in the UK. So people with vaccine injuries can claim on the vaccine damage payment scheme for up to £120,000, which is absolutely nothing. But in the Crown Dependencies, they are not entitled to vaccine injury payment scheme. They're completely excluded from it. So the FOI that they sent in a freedom of information, and they were basically asking why is it that Jersey has not set up a vaccination damage program for people damaged by the COVID jab? Why not their own compensation scheme, when Jersey was aware that the UK scheme would not cover people's vaccinations in Jersey? And the answer, quite shockingly, was basically saying that in the event that the COVID-19 vaccine results in Jersey residents suffering any kind of injury result of unforeseen side effects of the vaccine, it's possible that the government of Jersey, as well as the manufacturers and suppliers of vaccine, could be liable. However, in the absence of a scheme, there is nothing going on. So the National Vaccine Damage Payment Scheme is not available to any of these people that are literally being just stranded, just left completely abandoned with nowhere to go. So I just want to highlight an article that came up in the Jersey Evening Post and threats to sue from groups seeking vaccine damages. If we go on further into that article, you can see that they're just desperate and they're urging the government to make good. Otherwise, they will sue. And Richard Renov's promise was, well, I mean, honestly, he reassured Islanders apparently that yellow card schemes only records possible reactions. So far, 12 deaths have been recorded, as well as 839 adverse reactions. So, you know, the situation is beyond awful. The yellow card scheme, they say, only reports possible reactions. So therefore, Jersey is currently currently not covered. Neither is Guernsey and neither are the Isle of Man. But tonight there's a very important live Zoom event at 7 o'clock, and everyone watching is invited to participate. There are limited places, but there are still plenty of places. And this is to link up with Andrew Bridgen and a stellar panel of speakers, really, Professor Angus Dalgleish, Dr. Pierre Corey, phenomenal. But we're going to speak to Danny in a minute, who's leading the group. Danny Hervé, she's absolutely incredible, and she's organised this tonight because they are absolutely desperate. She herself is vaccine bereaved, and I was fortunate enough to catch up with her earlier today. Have a listen to what she said.
People really can't believe that the Channel Islands have just been left like this without any kind of access to any support whatsoever. And it's really shocking, especially when you consider that, you know, we were supplied all the vaccines from the UK government, yet we, because we're a Crown dependency, we've got no access to the vaccine damage payment scheme. So people have just been left completely out on their own and in the cold. It is shocking, really.
Tell us, where are we up to today in the Channel Islands? What's going on?
Okay, so in the Channel Islands at the moment, the last record was around 839 people who were adversely affected from the COVID vaccines, and 14 registered deaths by the MHRA yellow card scheme. Unfortunately, there's not as much visibility around the adverse events that we would like, but there are certainly a lot of people that are injured and they don't have access to any sort of support at all, which is the reason, yeah, that we're here today to talk about the event.
And this is the event that we really want lots and lots of people to register for, don't we? So we're putting out a plea to everybody that's watching now. This event that's going on tonight at 7 o'clock on Zoom with Andrew Bridgen and a stellar lineup of speakers. How do we register for this? Where do people go to, Danny?
So it is an amazing event. We've been very lucky to organise it in a very short period of time. And so there are a few spaces left. If people would like to participate or register, they can do. They can email the VIBJSY at proton.me email account. They can do that. Or they can access a registration link in the Facebook or the Instagram account, which is under the same name, VIBJSY.
And the link is also on our Twitter page.
And it will be in the show notes later on. And I think it was in the show notes on Wednesday's programme as well. If you want to get access to it right now, go to the UK Column website and have a look at Wednesday's news programme. Thank you very much for that, Debbie. Now let's move on to migration and the Rwanda Bill Act, as it now is, because of course it's passed. Rwanda has been turned into a safe country as a result of legislation, and so we are going to start sending people over there. Last night on the Question Time programme on the BBC, British MP Chris Philp had this to say.
Look, I think it's essential that we stop these boat crossings. There's a number of reasons. Firstly, they are dangerous. We saw five people dying earlier this week, including a young girl. Those aren't the first deaths. Secondly, these crossings are unnecessary because France is a safe country. Nobody needs to flee war in France. The people crossing are those who are able to pay people smugglers. They are almost entirely young men. And there are other people that we would want to welcome. Families, children, people with vulnerabilities, people that come from more dangerous places, as we have done, welcoming people directly from Syria, Afghanistan and Ukraine, for example. So we do have to stop these boats, which are dangerous and unnecessary. Now, the question was, will the programme, the Rwanda plan, actually work? And there are two examples, two case studies that I can give in support of the hypothesis that it will act as a deterrent.
So the first one that he gave was the Australia situation. And I just wanted to mention that because he's really been pretty disingenuous here in suggesting that Australia solved their problem of boat migration by doing what Britain is doing here. So in fact, what happened was that they set up, they had been shipping people to Papua New Guinea. Both of their main parties over there were following the same policy, and it didn't work for them. They ended up filling their migration centres in Papua New Guinea very, very quickly. They ended up having to bring migrants back to Australia. And the issue only changed whenever they changed their tack and they set up Operation Sovereign Borders. And a key constituent of that is that they started turning the boats back, so the boats were not able to arrive on shore. And that has done much more to solve the problem for Australia. They basically have abandoned their shipping people out to other places at the moment, as far as the various coverage of the Australia situation goes. But let's just consider the numbers that we're talking about here. So if we have a look at irregular migrants, this is the latest statistics from gov.uk, 52,530 irregular, as they describe it, migrants June 2022 to June 2023. 85% of those came over in small boats. So that's 44,650. Now, Chris Philp there said that these are mostly young men. I just make the point that one of the five people that died the day before yesterday was a young girl, I think 7 years old. So it's not entirely the case that it's mostly young men, but I think young men are perhaps coming in other ways. But anyway, the point here is it's 44,650 people coming in this way. So we'll put that back on screen again and just consider that number for a second, because how many places do the migration centres in Rwanda have? Well, the current number is still 1,000 over 5 years. We haven't seen any update to that. They've been talking about doing some extra building, but it's not going to be a significant change from this. So this is going to have zero impact, in fact, on the migration situation. And we should just mention that I can't remember when this, November last year, the BBC reporting that the Home Office were saying 17,000 of those migrants had already gone missing. And we have been reporting here at the UK column the number of child migrants that have been going missing over the years from the UK's care system. And then just to finish off here, the other point I would make is that the two guys that have been arrested for the five deaths that happened on Monday, or whichever day it was this week, were both from Sudan. And there is a massive war going on, a civil war going on in Sudan at the moment. It's very much being underreported in the Western media. It's pretty much going on without any comment. It's having a massive effect on displacement of people. And a lot of those people are coming to Europe and ultimately coming to try to come to the UK. Here's the point. Sudan is once again one of the countries where large amounts of conflict, stability and security fund money go from the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office. And this is just an example from a few years ago. Support for local peace building and addressing gender-based violence. This was money going into Sudan. What actually happens to it when it goes over there? There is quite a bit of evidence to suggest that, in fact, the comma, if we just put that on screen again for a second, if you look at the title, Conflict, Stability and Security Fund, there's a comma between conflict and stability. I would argue that the evidence demonstrates that actually that comma is inappropriate. This money is going to stabilize conflict and to secure conflict around the world, because that is what helps Britain's foreign policy agenda. And everywhere we see this money go, we see more conflict, not less. So that would be my final point in this. Ben, what are your thoughts on that? And what are your thoughts on the Rwanda situation?
So my thoughts on the Rwanda situation is that it's basically a trolling exercise on the part of the government. It's designed to enrage the left, or people who are kind of pro-immigration, pro-refugee, and it's designed to kind of placate people who are concerned about illegal immigration, but without actually fixing the issue. And as you pointed out, there's absolutely no way that the recommendation, this course of action, is going to solve the problem, such as it is. And also, illegal immigration is as serious a problem as I believe it is for the country. Is actually, again, itself a bit of a sidebar, given we've had 1.5 million legal immigrants come into the country over the past 12 months. right? So this whole thing is a mess, and yet it's almost certainly by design, as you pointed out.
Yes, and as we pointed out on Wednesday's programme with the food security segment, and as Harry Metcalf was talking about in his YouTube video, the rise in population happening as quickly as it is happening and no signs of it stopping are going to have major implications for food security in the UK in the not too distant future. So anyway, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, we do need your support. Please head to support.ukcolumn.org. There are options to help us out there. All the options are there. Your support very much needed, as I say, and thank you very much to everybody that does help out. Whether you're supporting us financially or not, please do share material you find on the platform, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. You could pick something up at the UK Column shop, and there are plenty of items there for you to have a look at. Debbie, very briefly, your blog is not up just yet. It will be up immediately after the news programme, but what are you covering this week?
Well, it's an inverted world, and when does sustainability become unsustainable? And shockingly, 700,000 people, as we said earlier, have booked for a COVID booster. The autism stem cell cure, maybe I should have put a question mark behind that. And cancer checks, we'll come on to that in a minute.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder of the Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place in Wimborne and Dorset, 27th to the 30th of June. The promo code for 10% off tickets, UK Column, that is valid until midnight tonight. So you've got just a few more hours if you'd like to go to that. And we would very much encourage you to go to it. We will be there, and hopefully we'll be saying hello to as many people as possible. Also, we will be at the Stand in the Light Music Festival May 24th to 27th, and there's a promo code for that as well, which is UKC10. So get along to that one if you can as well. Now, where does that take us then? Charity's website traffic surges following Kate's cancer diagnosis. Debbie, an update on this?
Yeah, well, you know, I just want to forget cancel culture for a minute. Let's look at cancer culture, shall we? Because cancer, turbo cancer, young people, cancer levels and their cases are exponentially rising. One in two of us get cancer. Since when? Hunting cancer has been coined now. And how many cancer tests have you guys received through the door? You know, bowel tests or texts asking you to go for cancer tests. And we mustn't forget that the cancer test originally came from a company called Grail, which was founded by Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates with a very small amount of money. And then it was rolled out in the UK. And that's where now the UK appears to be the cancer capital of the world. And just recently, we are super keen to get out cancer tests. We don't have any staff to look after those that are sick, but we have plenty of staff to test healthy people for cancer. So the NHS website has just actually recorded that urgent cancer checks have topped 3 million. And we've got lung trucks in supermarkets. We've got cancer awareness messaging on urinal mats. And of course, we've got now Royal Messengers, and the traffic has gone up. It's surged on cancer websites because of the Princess of Wales. We have three members of the royal family who are trusted messengers, what I would call trusted messengers. We have the Princess of Wales, we have the King, and we have the Duchess of York. And it's interesting that only today they've revealed that the melanoma mRNA injection is now being rolled out for cancer. So this is very much a cancer agenda. This last week, the NHS board meeting was released on YouTube, and I want to direct everybody to that YouTube. I mean, it's really important that we watch these board meetings. Much was spoken about cancer, genomics, and ADHD, which we'll come on to another time. But basically, they were figuring very highly this announcement by the Princess of Wales. Cancer figures very highly on the NHS boardroom agenda. Here's a little snippet of the NHS board meeting, which has just been released.
And I think it's probably a reminder that receiving a cancer diagnosis at any time can be hugely daunting. But by bravely speaking out in the way that the Princess of Wales has done about her diagnosis. We know that that will, in fact, it already has encouraged others to do the same. And by the simple act of raising awareness, that will save lives. So we've seen cancer information pages on the NHS website have had a huge spike in visits since the Princess's video message. I can tell you, just checking the stats, there were 2,840 visits to the page on cancer in the 24 hours after the announcement. That is a rise of 373% just over that 24-hour period. So we know, we talk about it a lot at this board, that the earlier that you can detect cancer, the better, because the earlier that can be diagnosed means you have a higher chance of successful treatment. And so whilst we are diagnosing early stage cancer we're diagnosing more cancers, to get it really precise, at an earlier stage than ever, and survival rates are at an all-time high, we do want to continue to encourage people to come forward when they are concerned about symptoms, not wait. So anyone with unusual or worrying symptoms should visit their GP, and it's just, a reminder of how important it is to take up screening appointments when offered.
So the trusted royal messengers appear to be doing their job and driving many, many people to an already overwhelmed NHS. But just staying on health and giving everybody a quick update, because I want to say that since we interviewed Dr. Charles Hoff the other day, his interview can be found on the website, The Ethical Doctor, David versus Goliath, Dr. Charles Hoff. So many people have asked me, what's the update with his court appearance and his court date? He has sacrificed pretty much everything. He's even lost his whole town in a fire. And he has a legal defense fund page here. That money goes straight to his solicitors. It doesn't go to him. But if you would like to contribute, he would be super grateful. And he has sent us an update as to what is happening. He sent me an email. So we've now got a little snippet of it, I think. Dear Debbie, the college has adjourned the April 19th hearing to decide on judicial notice. My lawyer has made a very compelling response to their application, and I can see that they are now delaying things to decide what to do next. They clearly are desperate to prevent the truth from coming out. There is no new date set for a hearing. We shall wait and see. If they have any sense, they will drop all the charges. But I don't think they have enough humility to do that. And then he went on to end by saying, fortunately, truth always wins in the end. And the longer they delay things, the more evidence appears in my favour. I will draw my lawyer's attention to the writ of mandamus. Thank you to Jean, who sent him that. Thank you for mentioning it. Thank you again for your wonderful support. Keep up the good work, Charles Hoff, MD. So thank you very much to Charles for giving us that update. And also thank you to Wynne, who has written an amazing email to Dame June Rain. I won't read it out. I'll just let you have a look at the slides and have an idea of what is being written to the MHRA with regards to the data on vaccinated women, because we really need this data. June Rain is like another rat leaving the sinking ship. Please follow this wonderful example and get your letters, get your emails in. We need that data.
Brilliant, Debbie. Thank you very much for that. Now, this week is not the only anniversary of the founding of the Commonwealth. It was Earth Day, Ben, so we should be very excited about that, shouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It was Earth Day on Monday, on the 22nd, and it's been Earth Day on the 22nd of April since 1970, when US Senator Gaylord Nelson instigated an Earth Day, and that led to the setting up of the US Environmental Protection Agency that same year. They've been doing wonderful work, I'm sure. And what better excuse to push out an extraordinary amount of climate propaganda than Earth Day? I'm going to show two examples just to give you a flavour of what we're seeing out here and how it's being used to influence behaviour across the system. The first one comes here from the UN and our very own Nesta. So you can see it's not just about climate, it's also about justice, it's all about diversity, it's about getting marginalised folks into the decision-making process, it's about tapping into new types of funding, it's a top-down transformation of the entire system. That was a little video summarising a 60-page report from the United Nations Development Programme, which has accelerator labs in 115 countries, and is a partnership between them and Nesta, which is the National Endowment for Science and Technology and the Arts, is a UK government institution which owns the Behavioural Insights team. Right, so that's where that stuff's coming from. That's very much focused on international audiences. But we got another example here. I said I had two examples. This second one from Futera and BeWorks, the Low Carbon Lifestyles Wheel. And Futera was seeded by Nesta. Right, so this is another Nesta-type organization. It's part of the same ecosystem. And they've developed the Action Wheel, which basically gives you a whole bunch of things that you can do, your organization can do, you can try and get other people to do in order to accelerate climate action. It's designed for use by internal teams inside organizations, entrepreneurs, new product developers, branding and marketing teams, the C-suite. Absolutely everyone should get their hands on this. And it spells out the benefits, whether those are functional, emotional, or social benefits to taking climate action. All of this came out on Monday. And this is just a tiny, tiny slither of the type of propagandizing and actionable toolkits and plans that are out there for people to begin acting on what we're being told is a climate emergency.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thank you, Ben. We're going to move on to AI and a report at PsycNet. The title of this is Facial Recognition Technology and Human Raters Can Predict Political Orientation from the Images of Expressionless Faces Even When Controlling for Demographics and Self-Preservation. So let's have a look at what they're saying here. Carefully standardized facial images of 591 participants were taken in the laboratory while controlling for self-presentation, facial expression, head orientation, and image properties. They were presented to human raters and a facial recognition algorithm. Both humans and the algorithm could predict participant scores on a political orientation scale decorrelated with age, gender, and ethnicity. Moreover, the associations between facial appearance and the political orientation seem to generalize beyond our sample. The predictive model derived from standardized images could predict political orientation from naturalistic images of 3,401 politicians from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. They go on to say that we demonstrate that political orientation can be predicted from neural facial images by both humans and algorithms, even when factors like age, gender, and ethnicity are accounted for. This indicates a connection between political leanings and inherent facial characteristics, which are largely beyond an individual's control. Our findings underscore the urgency for scholars, the public, and policymakers to recognize and address the potential risks of facial recognition technology to personal privacy. Perhaps most crucially, our findings suggest that widespread biometric surveillance technologies are more threatening than previously thought. Now, that is a peer-reviewed paper. I recommend that everybody reads it in full considers the implications of it. But in the meantime, we see the increasing rollout of AI across government. And here we go. Here's the next one, a handshake here, because the UK government has now decided to create an incubator for artificial intelligence. That's been going for a little while, but they've entered in an agreement with NHS England. They're calling this the Collaborative Charter on AI, and this will empower the NHS workforce to use AI to improve patient care and staff experience, as well as operational efficiency. The collaboration charter is a fantastic thing. Here's what Oliver Dowden had to say about it. I hope you appreciate that was slightly sarcastic. Anyway, AI is potentially, he said, and I don't say this lightly, a silver bullet. It dangles before us the prospect of increased productivity, vast efficiency savings, and improved services. I should say that he made this statement in a speech that he was giving at Imperial College in London. He went on to say, in healthcare, AI diagnostic tools could transform primary care with appointments transcribed in real time by ambient AI, then instantly producing prescriptions and referrals. Which appointments is he talking about? Because as we all know, nobody can get appointments at the moment. But anyway, he went on to say it will also improve scans read by AI with further accuracy, with far greater accuracy, and medicines tailored to individuals based on their genetics, again, using AI. But it's not just healthcare, because in this same speech, he also talked about education. By coincidence, last week, Hyperion Dev, as this is their tweet, represented by our CEO and founder, Riaz Mullah, participated in a landmark EdTech roundtable hosted in London by Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden and Education Secretary Gillian Keegan of the UK government. And the roundtable had everybody on it. So they had representatives from Duolingo, from Hyperion Dev, as we've just seen, from GoodNotes, from TeachMate AI, from Portsmouth Education Partnership, LEO Academy Trust, StepLab, and a whole bunch of others, all wanting to get involved and embrace AI as being the great savior of humanity. But Ben, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this, but my observation would be that if we look at how we have been, humanity has been dumbed down by something as simple as GPS and not needing to read a map anymore. What happens when we start introducing AI on a broad scale to our children? The whole issue of trust then and where we get our information from becomes clear for the children, but they perhaps don't get an education.
Well, I think the point is that we actually have no idea what's going to happen when we start introducing it. I'm personally of the view that kids under the age of 18 shouldn't have access to certainly mobile phones, potentially computers, and definitely not artificial intelligence. I mean, it just seems crazy that this is even being discussed.
Indeed. But let's come on to the issue of media and so on. And NPR.
Absolutely, yeah. So NPR is the American version of the BBC, basically. It's a publicly funded radio station, and its chief executive, Catherine Meyer, who was also formerly at Wikipedia as chief executive, has been doing the rounds recently on Telegram, certainly, because of a few public statements that she's made. And I'm going to play one now, and then I'm interested to see what people's thoughts on it are.
I started by talking about the idea of free and open as some of our founding principles, sort of free and open source, coming from the idea of the open source community. Well, I have come to the opinion and the perspective that free and open was a way of looking at the world that was inherently limited relative to what we were trying to achieve. Free and open has the best of intentionality, but in the end, what free and open often ended up doing, and particularly in the case of Wikipedia, was really recapitulating many of the same power structures and dynamics that exist offline prior to the advent of the internet. And so what we ended up seeing was Wikipedia really rebuilt this idea of knowledge as a whole around what the Western canon. You see the exclusion of communities, of languages, because of the ways in which Wikipedia is based on reliable sources. The idea of a written tradition is something that is particular to the idea of a written tradition, which is particular to some cultures and not to others, the ways in which I'd ascribe notability often really comes from sort of this white male, Westernized construct around who matters in societies and who is elevated and whose voices. And so some of these ideas of sort of this radical openness really did not end up with the intention, really did not end up living into the intentionality of what openness can be.
So the first thing is, I don't know what intentionality is, but she really likes it. And it seems to be one of these academic terms that gets used by progressive liberal women in particular. That was really striking to me, right? So this is a woman who has an extraordinary amount of power as it relates to public discourse and the shaping of public opinion. And she thinks that free speech, free and open access to the internet is perpetuating historical inconsistencies or inadequacies with our system. She thinks that she can, it's her job essentially, as part of her intentionality, is to remodel society on the internet. It's a really remarkable statement that she's made there. I don't know what you think about it, Mike.
Well, she's talking about a ministry of truth, isn't she? She's talking about having the power to change history. I'm just going to say, Ben, as I can't remember the book, but you know, we were talking about H.G. Wells earlier in the program. H.G. Wells wrote a whole swathe of books on global governance and how he wanted to shape the world and all this kind of stuff. And in one of the other books, the key feature that he was, or the key agenda item that he was attempting to encourage us to have was a global encyclopedia. And here we have one. And as you rightly say, it has such a huge influence on how people view the world and how the people view history, because they want to present themselves as the sort of bastion of trust and the bastion of authority. And we know that there are many, many inaccuracies on Wikipedia. But if that becomes the foundation of trusted information in the world, well, we can see how somebody that has, what was the word, an intentionality, intend that our views are changed on certain topics, or our memories of what happened in the past are amended over time.
Yeah, and it's this idea that reality is just a projection of prejudices or something, and that if we change the narrative, then that will change the underlying structure. Like, it's a really odd worldview, but it's coming right from the top. Everywhere, frankly, right? And just to note, is Catherine Meyer sitting with Jimmy Wales there with the Czech shirt on? He's the founder of Wikipedia. And Jimmy Wales is actually a trustee of Nesta. Yeah, so the people who own the Behavioural Insights team, the people that did that big UN report we just talked about, who are in the thick of all of this global discussion, pushing this progressive narrative, right in at the top level at Wikipedia, which is one of the main online news information sources.
Yes, indeed. Well, Ben, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, because good news, everyone, there's a new organization fighting disinformation in the world. It's called the American Sunlight Project. This is the header image from their website. It's fantastic. In a world clouded by disinformation, we're on a mission to bring clarity, is what they say. So I wonder who's behind that. Well, it's none other than Nina Jankowicz, Biden's Homeland Security disinformation czar, as she was until she lost the job 5 minutes after she got it, because she was just so unbelievably fascistic in her approach that nobody was prepared to accept it. We should never forget her little video, which Stephanie banned me from playing again today. So everybody, please send Stephanie a thank you message by email or something for making sure that you didn't have to put up with her singing that silly tune again. But this is what she has to say about this whole thing. The campaign against counter-disinformation work is the greatest threat to freedom of expression that the academic integrity since the McCarthy era. Ben, I don't know what you think about that, but it seems to me that what she represents is McCarthyism.
Yeah, they have absolutely no self-awareness or sense of irony, these people. It's kind of staggering, actually. I wonder if she's ever actually sat down to think about how absurd it is that she denied the existence of the Hunter Biden laptop in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election. She was one of the people out there saying, this is Russian disinformation, we can't possibly listen to this. She was completely wrong. And yet, apparently, she's still presenting herself as some kind of bastion of truth. She should probably go and hang around with Catherine Meyer from NPR. In fact, they almost certainly got each other on speed dial. So, yeah, this is what we're up against.
Yes. The comment in the chat box, by the way, is that Stephanie has saved Friday again. So let's bring Nina back on screen. And this is what she finished off by saying. Disinformation knows no political party. Its ultimate victim is our democracy. Whose democracy? Your democracy? Because I don't think you represent democracy, Nina. Anyway, and another person that's involved in this is, there are a number of people involved in it. The advisory board has Katie Harbath, who's a former Facebook executive, Emily Holm, former National Security Council, U.S. National Security Council official. Inika Bushevitz, is the Gay Advocacy Group Movement Advancement Project representative. And on screen here, Benjamin Vittes is the left from the what is described as the left-wing Brookings Institution. He was once called the Bard of the Deep State. So anyway, it's a nice combination they've got there. But coming back to the UK very briefly, I just mentioned that the Ofcom has published their research, their guide on the research that they're doing for online safety work. They very much do feature misinformation in that, because they say that that's one of the most prevalent potential harms encountered by both adults and children online. And they're particularly interested in emerging tactics, techniques and procedures for disinformation campaigns and any emerging actors. They're also interested in the prevalence of mis or disinformation and its correlation with significant moments and events, such as political developments or humanitarian crises. And the means by which online locations become associated with mis or disinformation over time. We will talk more about their research in due course, but just a final reminder that they are continuing to ask for views on implementing the Online Safety Act and specifically additional duties for categorised online services. You'll notice that one of the category one online services, that'd be Twitter, Facebook, these types of large social media platforms, are required to protect, under the guidelines so far, to protect news publishers and journalistic content, and any content which is viewed as being of democratic importance. So that type of content, as long as it comes from a mainstream media source or a recognized news publisher source, is protected. And anything anybody else says, whether it's evidenced or not, is likely to be taken down. So we will keep you posted on this as we go. But Debbie, we have an Anne finally here, and we'll just leave with this particular one. You describe it.
I thought this was rather lovely. The youth may walk fast, but it's elders who know the road. And we do, don't we? Experience counts for a lot. Life's experiences.
Well, that's true. We have a little bit more time. So we also had a trigger warning.
Oh, yeah. Trigger warning, everybody, right now. So we've previously revealed the saviour of the world, the statue of Prince Charles, which caused a huge amount of stir on the UK column and with our audiences, and went global and all over the place, those pictures. But I've got something else to show you. I'm probably not going to say anything about it until you watch it, and then you might want to make a comment. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this next clip in Extra.
Sculptor Egon Chosa is putting the finishing touches on a statue of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Here in Kosovo, Chosa and other ethnic Albanians idolized the British politician. National records indicate more than 10 people are named Tony Blair, Tony, or Blair. The spellings altered to fit local pronunciations. Tony Blair Gashi was born 2 years after the war. His name chosen by his father.
He wanted to pay a tribute of our people, of our gratitude of Kosovan people toward Tony Blair. And he always wanted to have a boy so he can name him after Tony Blair. And pretty much that's what happened in 2001 when they had me.
Now 22, Gashi met the real Blair when he visited Pristina in 2010. Blair was greeted by several boys, all named after the politician. The moment stuck with the young Gashi.
It was like meeting pretty much a prophet for our people.
The life-size clay statue of Blair will be cast in bronze and placed on Blair Boulevard in the eastern town of Ferizaj. The ceremony will take place on June 12th, which marks the end of the 1998-99 Kosovo War. It was commissioned by the We Remember Tony Blair Foundation. The former British Prime Minister has been invited to the statue's inauguration, but there's no word yet on whether he will attend.
Well, Debbie, I don't really know what to say about that.
That's precisely why I put the trigger warning out. But, you know, for people that want to go and have a look, it will be placed eventually on Blair Boulevard.
Excellent. I can't think of anything better to do with your time. But okay, thank you for that, Debbie. Thank you for ending on that note. We do have to leave it there for today. Undoubtedly, we will have more to say in Extra. Ben is clearly queuing up for quite a few comments. If you are a UK Column member, join us for Extra in a few minutes. Just stay on the stream here. Otherwise, we'll be back at 1 p.m. on Monday, as usual, for more news. I hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.